Welcome to HN Pod, your daily dive into the top stories and wildest debates from the front page of Hacker News. Today is March 7th, 2026, and this is episode number 328. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. We have a fantastic lineup for you today. We are looking at why LLM-generated code might look perfect but run 20,000 times slower than it should. We are also checking out a new AST-based text editor, celebrating a decade of Docker containers, and diving into the Go standard library finally adopting UUIDs.
Plus, a massive breakthrough in cancer radiotherapy from CERN that has the entire Hacker News community collectively sweating over the name of the company building it. You'll see why later.
Let us kick things off with our top story today. It's a brilliant post from Vagabond Research titled, "Your LLM Does Not Write Correct Code, It Writes Plausible Code." This one racked up over 400 points.
It is such a good read. The author, who goes by DNW, decided to benchmark a ground-up Rust rewrite of SQLite that was entirely generated by an LLM. On the surface, this AI-generated database looked amazing. It compiled, it passed all its tests, it read and wrote the correct SQLite file format, and it even had a drop-in C API.
Right. It looked like a working database, but then the author ran a simple benchmark, doing a primary key lookup on 100 rows. System SQLite did it in 0.09 milliseconds. The LLM-generated Rust version took over 1,800 milliseconds. That's 20,000 times slower.
20,000! And it wasn't just a misplaced comma. The LLM completely missed fundamental database design principles. For instance, in SQLite, when you declare an integer primary key, it becomes an alias for the internal B-tree key, which makes lookups scale logarithmically. The LLM completely missed this architectural decision, resulting in massive full table scans.
Exactly. As the author put it, LLMs optimize for plausibility over correctness. The code looked like a database. It had a parser, a planner, a B-tree, a pager. All the modules had the right names, but the underlying logic was just an illusion of competence.
The comments on this thread were phenomenal. A user named Pornal pointed out that an LLM's default solution to a problem is to just keep digging. If you tell an LLM the code is slow, it will not rethink the architecture. It will just add optimized fast paths, specialized routines, custom data structures, and basically generate fractally more code to patch up the problems it created in the first place.
That fractal code generation is such a real phenomenon. I have definitely fallen into that trap. But there was another great insight in the comments from GHGN, who noted a bimodal distribution and how people use these tools. The developers who act like a combination of an architect and a product manager, the ones who set up the guardrails and define strict acceptance criteria before generating a single line of code, they get great results.
Yes, the people who just walk up and say, "sudo, make me a sandwich," are the ones getting 20,000 times performance regressions. It really highlights how the mechanical part of grinding out code is becoming commoditized, but the architectural thinking, the legwork of defining constraints, is more valuable than ever.
Speaking of how we write code, our next story is about Kid Editor, which is a new text editor that operates directly on the abstract syntax tree, or AST. This one got around 340 points.
For those who might not be familiar, most text editors treat your code as just a dumb string of characters, but an AST-based editor actually understands the syntactic structure of your programming language. Kid Editor uses this to offer first-class syntax node interaction. So instead of using your mouse or keyboard to highlight a block of text, you can select and manipulate entire logical structures, like a whole function or all the arguments in a method call.
It also features multiple cursors for parallel syntax node operations, which sounds like an absolute dream for massive refactoring jobs.
The Hacker News crowd loved this, but it also brought up a lot of nostalgia and power user tips. A user named ScriptSmith mentioned that this reminds them of the expand and shrink selection shortcuts in JetBrains IDEs.
Oh yeah, Control-W on Windows or Command-W on Mac.
Right, which expands your selection logically from a variable to the statement to the block to the function. Once you get used to it, going back to a regular text editor feels barbaric. Though, as someone joked in the comments, muscle memory for Control-W is dangerous, because if you use it in a web browser, you just close your tab.
I have definitely done that. But the history of AST editing goes way back. Someone pointed out that Mathematica had this feature in its notebook interface in the early 90s. And of course, the Lisp programmers chimed in to remind us that structural editing is just a Tuesday for them. When your language is basically just an AST already, tools like Parrotit make manipulating code incredibly fluid.
The challenge with AST editors, which a user named CyberAxe pointed out, is that sometimes during a refactor, your code has to pass through an invalid state. If the editor strictly enforces the AST, it can feel really clumsy when you are just trying to move things around. But with TreeSitter becoming ubiquitous and maybe AI helping bridge those invalid states, I think we are going to see a lot more editors adopting this structural approach.
Moving down the front page, we have a big update for the Go ecosystem. Proposal issue 62026 has been accepted, meaning a UUID package is finally coming to the Go standard library.
This is one of those things where you kind of assume it was already there. Almost every Go project that touches a database ends up importing the Google/UUID package. It is such a staple that adding it to the standard library just makes sense. The new crypto/UUID package will support generating and parsing versions 3, 4, and 5.
But Sarah, you know Hacker News. You cannot just post about UUIDs without sparking a massive architectural debate.
Oh, absolutely. The comments immediately derailed into an intense discussion about which UUID versions are actually good. Someone made a comment claiming that versions 1 through 5 are outdated, which triggered a fierce defense of UUID version 4.
Right. Version 4 is the fully random one. It's still the gold standard for primary keys in distributed databases like CockroachDB or Google Spanner because it prevents hotspotting. If your IDs are sequential, all your database writes hit the same node. Random UUIDs spread the load perfectly.
But then you have the fans of version 7, which includes a timestamp. Version 7 gives you that rough ordering, which is great for certain database engines, where you want records created around the same time to be stored near each other on disk.
My favorite part of the thread was when someone asked, if you just want 128 bits of randomness, why use the UUID format at all? Why not just use a random 16-byte array?
And the responses were basically a masterclass in why standards exist. Sure, 16 bytes is fine, until you have to send it over a wire. Then you have to worry about endianness. Or how do you serialize it in JSON? Do you use Base64? Hex? The UUID standard solves all these second and third order problems. It gives you a canonical string representation that every language and database on Earth already knows how to parse.
Exactly. It is not rocket science, but it is a solved standardization problem, and putting it in the Go standard library just removes one more dependency from the supply chain.
Next up, we have a fascinating retrospective from the communications of the ACM, titled A Decade of Docker Containers.
Though, as the comments quickly pointed out, Docker actually debuted in 2013 at PyCon, making it more like 13 years old. But hey, a decade sounds better in a headline.
It really does. The article dives deep into the technical foundations of Docker. We all take Docker build and Docker run for granted now, but the engineering required to make it a frictionless developer experience was incredible. They took Linux namespaces, which were already a thing, and made them accessible.
The most fascinating part of the article for me was how they got Docker to work on Mac and Windows, the embedded Linux within desktop applications using library virtual machine monitors. But the real genius was how they handled networking. They actually repurposed a tool from the 1990s called Slurp, which was originally used for dial-up connections for Palm Pilots.
Wait, Palm Pilots?
Yes, they used it to translate container network traffic through host system calls instead of network bridging, which magically bypassed all the corporate firewall restrictions that would normally block virtual machines. It is the ultimate duct tape engineering that ended up powering modern cloud development.
That is incredible. In the comments, there was a lot of nostalgia for Solomon Hayek's original Lightning talk in 2013, but it also sparked the eternal debate between Dockerfiles and Nix.
Ah, yes, the Nix evangelists have entered the chat.
They always do. The argument is that Dockerfiles are a leaky abstraction. You start from a base image, you run apt update, and suddenly your build is dependent on whatever is on the internet at that exact second. It is not truly reproducible. Nix, on the other hand, guarantees absolute hermeticity.
But a user named bmitch3020 nailed by the Dockerfile won and continues to dominate. It is just so flexible. It perfectly mirrored what operations teams were already doing manually. Yes, it is ugly. Yes, achieving truly reproducible builds with Docker requires jumping through hoops with timestamps and tarfile metadata. But the ability to just throw a requirements.txt into a folder and run pip install without learning a new functional programming language is why Docker took over the world.
Our final story today is a shift away from software, but it is an incredible piece of engineering. From IEEE Spectrum, the article is titled, "Flash Radiotherapy's Bold Approach to Cancer Treatment."
This is a wild medical breakthrough. For over a century, traditional radiation therapy has been giving patients relatively low doses of X-rays over dozens of sessions. It kills the tumor, but it also causes massive collateral damage to healthy tissue.
But researchers working with CERN, the particle physics lab in Europe, are developing something called flash radiotherapy. Instead of slow, low doses, they use a linear particle accelerator to deliver a single, ultra-high-power burst of radiation that lasts less than 1/10 of a second.
And the crazy part is, it works better. In studies, this millisecond blast kills the cancer cells but causes significantly less injury to normal healthy tissue. The prevailing theory is that it has to do with metabolism and how healthy cells versus cancerous cells process the sudden spike in reactive oxygen species.
It is an amazing application of high-energy physics. But Mike, we have to talk about the Hacker News reaction because it is the most predictable software engineer reaction possible.
Oh, I know exactly what you are going to say. The French company collaborating with CERN to build these medical accelerators is named Theryq, T-H-E-R-Y-Q.
Yes, and every single software engineer reading that immediately had a cold sweat because it sounds exactly like Theryq 25.
For anyone who did not take a computer science ethics class, the Theryq 25 was a radiation therapy machine from the 1980s that was involved in one of the worst software engineering disasters in history. They removed hardware safety interlocks and relied entirely on software, but a race condition in the code caused the machine to deliver massive, lethal overdoses of radiation to patients.
It is the ultimate cautionary tale of software engineering. So seeing a new, experimental, ultra-high-power radiation machine being built by a company called Theryq just sent the comment section into a spiral. As user BillGoZero has put it, even among researchers, people are a little superstitious. It is like asking how to kill a product on day one.
A user named Erroneous Bosch said they reread the Theryq 25 incident paper every few months because they work on life-critical equipment. And they flat out said, "I am not sticking my head in a French particle accelerator named Theryq."
It is a bit unfair to the company, honestly. The medical world does not obsess over the Theryq 25 case study the way programmers do. To an oncologist, it is just a brand name. But it was hilarious to see the entire Hacker News community have a collective panic attack over the branding of a genuinely life-saving medical breakthrough.
It just goes to show, you can cure cancer with particle physics, but you cannot escape the naming critics on the internet.
And that is a wrap for today's episode of HN Pod. From 20,000 times slower LLM code to millisecond cancer treatments, it has been quite the journey.
If you want to dive into any of these articles or join the debates, we've got all the links in the show notes.
Thanks for hanging out with us today. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Mike. We'll catch you tomorrow with more top stories from Hacker News. Keep building and maybe double check your database indexes.